Good evening and welcome to the Icecast. My name is Shane Chebsey, and on the Icecast we talk about artists, writers and publishers, and we talk about their lives and their work and everything in between. And this evening on the Icecast I'm very happy to welcome publisher Mr. Ben Cullis. Good evening, Ben. How are you doing?
Very well, very well. I'm glad you got my name right, because I started off this year with this silly Banksy thing, and I've been living that down for a long time, mate. It's says it Ben K. Sai, whatever. And it's Banksy, mate. You know, trying to be a little bit kind of edgy, but yeah, Ben Cullis, how do you do? All right, mate.
Me
and Shane, we have met. I met him a rainy field. A rainy field out, obviously, in Shrewsbury, and that was the year that you had incarcerated John Wagner in the prison, which was hilarious.
Oh yeah, that's last year then.
Was it last year? Was it 18? Yeah, 18. We did. Were we saying?
Yeah, I think it was last year.
No, 19.
19. Yeah, we did Comic Salope. Yeah,
that was and I had such a lovely afternoon with a bunch of kids in the library with your man from Parkinson,
Nigel Parkinson.
And watching these kids just doing all that sketch, I got to say, yours was one of the nicest little, I don't mean that kind of, not little, I mean to say, one of the nicest, more relaxing festivals I went to that year.
Oh.
You go to Thought Bubble and it's just like full on madness. And then you go to Shrewsbury and it's just like, oh, wow, everyone's chilled.
Chilled out.
Yeah, exactly.
We did sort of want that. We want, you know, because it's in a chilled out town, it's spread out across the town. Outdoors for the most part, so yeah, we wanted it to be chilled.
Do you think all festivals are going to be outdoors from now on?
Well, it might have to be, might they? We have got an advantage there as well, because I mean, about 75% of the event is outdoors, so hopefully we'll obviously have to make some adjustments if they're, you know, if the COVID situation isn't sorted.
What a year. Let's hope we can get back to something, because it's been the oddest year, hasn't it? And I don't know about you, I'm missing meeting up with people, you know,
Desperately. Yeah. I mean, this is why I do this. It's like, how can I talk to all my friends or make new friends or anything like that? How can I have a social life at all? Oh, I can start a podcast. It's an extreme.
And I've listened to a few and I've really enjoyed them. So hopefully this one is going to be, you know, okay.
I'm sure you won't let us side down.
Thank you.
So my initial question, I guess, Ben, is where are you coming from in regards of the comic industry, because we're all aware that we're here today to talk about 77, which is with your anthology. So what was the inspiration and how did it become a thing?
Okay, so I know this is only going out visually, but obviously I look a lot younger than my ancient years. I'm in my mid-50s, mate, and I go back to being one of those kids who grew up with Action Comic. My first comic was Monster Fun. Okay, that was brilliant. Monster Fun was brilliant because it still had some Ken Reed, you know, and some of the old boys in it. And I didn't realise that at the time, but I loved those wacky faces. There was a kid there who changed his scrunge face or something. It was really weird. He'd be a normal face and it turned into some monster face. And I love that. And then the very next one, there's Hookjaw eating people, you know, proper Hookjaw, not New Rebellion, maybe there's a shark in the water every couple of pages, you know.
full on Pat Mills,
giving it, there are people being eaten every page. And I was 8 years old, mate, and I was like so into it,
It's great, wasn't it?
And what was the next one? I can't remember whether it was Death Game 1999 or they called it Spinball. But anyway, before the comic got banned, it was really gory. I remember, you know, there were people getting ripped up and people splashing against kind of, was it synthy plastic domes and just kind of crawl, you know, being, just obliterated. Oh, brilliant.
Great for kids.
Mate, didn't do me any harm at all. No.
Not me.
That's right. And then this totally mad British sci-fi comic just appeared. And I knew nothing about superheroes when I was a kid. Mm. We weren't even allowed to see. My mum is one of those mums who wouldn't let us watch ITV.
ITV. I had a few friends like that at school, actually, yeah.
Well, you see, that's it. I didn't know what spaghetti hoops was until I was 25. You know,
or Tiz was.
We were brought up on Whole Food.
And Swap
Shop. My mum was a bit of a hippie, so we didn't have telly, mate, you know.
Oh, anyway, wow.
So comics were my real rebellion, but it was a very, very specific few comics. So 2000 AD was the thing that really just got me going, yeah? Mm. So, you know, like a lot of people, dinosaurs, yeah? Very quickly, the dinosaurs from Flesh.
Yeah.
That artwork was amazing. But Bernardinelli, mate. Danny Dare. The Danny Dare stories were for a young kid were fine, but it sort of turned a little bit when Gibbons was doing the Lost Worlds and stuff right back in the 40s and 50s issues, you know, about 70,
78, 70, 79. Early 70s, yeah, early stuff, yeah.
I don't know, but Bernard Eddy's artwork was mental, absolutely mental. So I always was a kid, I drew and I drew and drew and drew, and basically my career was fairly underground. I worked in underground comics. I worked in an organization who were skate muties, and they created the Skate Muties from the Fifth Dimension, which some people will really know really well because they were skateboarders and punks, and it sold. Right. So around about mid-80s, when Viz was just starting to take over, when James Brown bought it from ABC.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So we were going on at the same time, and we tried to do a deal with him. We were on par selling comics with Viz. So we were selling 5,000 at a time, right? And this was just stapled together, distribution through whatever.
You could do that then, though, couldn't you? There was the market back then to do that sort
Absolutely. Of stuff. And all your head shops and your comic shops, everyone just seemed to buy. All of them had a rack with kind of indie or head comics in, you know? And zines were a thing. And so we're talking mid-80s here, and I created a few characters for them. They turned into something called Bugs and Drugs, and then they started contributing to Deadline. But by the time Deadline came out in 1989 or 1990, I'd moved on, and I was in animation and film editing. So I did comics for about, one of these people that kind of goes in and out of things. You know, I haven't ever really stayed long with something. So I did comics for about 4 years. And then I did film editing and animation and went on tour with a band that's signed to Island Records. I think you might know something about being in a band, Shane.
But nothing that big, mate.
I don't know. I spent quite a lot on a double album to get someone to just do me a little picture once at I have got your double album, mate. It's very nice.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. With the weird kind of what's that weird manta ray thing on the front cover? Is that
it's a cosmic ray.
It's a cosmic ray.
Yeah, of course.
So yeah, well the band that I was in was called Startled Insects. Now there we go. Right. Cosmic Rays and Startled Insects. Now they were kind of big with the BBC because they did a lot of soundtrack music for wildlife programs.
Right.
And that's where they went, okay? Yeah. And I was involved in the AV stuff. So I was doing audio, video. We were doing a lot of animation work for them. And I started working then with people who were working at Aardman's Animation in Bristol. Right. So that's where I was based, okay? Yeah. And worked on a really, really neat film called The Adventures of Tom Thumb, which kind of is known amongst people who like kind of really weird animation films. So it's a feature, and it's this pixelation where people are animated. So, you know, human beings are animated. So it's not digital, it's all in front of camera. And that went out and scared the living bejesus. They showed the pilot at Christmas.
It's a bit creepy looking, wasn't it? If I remember.
Yeah, well, they showed the pilot, a 10-minute pilot on the BBC, and kind of got the wrong idea. They sold it as a kids' program, and it's so freaky. And they had hundreds of complaints. It's great for the filmmakers, because obviously, you know, they kind of it got notified.
Yeah, notoriety.
Notoriety.
Yeah.
And I worked on that, on the pilot, for about 4 months. And actually, we went to Bristol, back to Bristol, to the art centre there last year. I think it must, last winter. And it was the 25th anniversary of it being released. But it's a film that took 5 years to make. Now, so my history in animation, like Jan Sankmeyer, all the Czech animators, these are people who spend years making films, right? The guys who do everything. So that was my style, and I did all that sort of stuff. And after a while, you just go, you know, you lose it.
It's it's a long time to be on one project, isn't it?
I'll tell you what, and how can I put this? The things you do to yourself to make sure you can stay up for many, many nights and do all this work.
I can only imagine.
In a good place, does not harbour good things. So
no.
I kind of made a decision in my mid-20s to sort of get out of it and went to college, And from there, I taught film and animation, and I did video editing. So I did some video editing for U2 on the Europa tour. Big stadium stuff, isn't it? And it's just all those little bits of the film work and what have you. And then I got into more teaching, and I've been teaching now for 20-odd years. And then a couple of things happened to me. I always have to mention this now. Okay, so unfortunately, I'd met a lovely lady, and we've had 3 kids by the time I was 27. And unfortunately, my eldest one, he passed away 5 years ago, right?
Oh, so,
as a you know, responsible human being, as a dad, as someone who loses somebody, it does make you question what you're doing with yourself, you know, especially if I can just say that James, bless him, he got me back into comics, right?
Really? So,
yeah, through a business problem with a business, I had to literally sell, I don't know if you've done this, Shane, I had to sell my entire comic collection.
Oh, thankfully, I've not had to do that yet. Not yet,
so
no.
Everything hopefully went. Never. I mean, I'm, you know, it's mad. I mean, when I think about the stuff which I sold, and I made okay money, do you know what I mean? You know, we're talking, I had four or five collections of Watchmen and drawings, you know, and sort of a lot of Alan Moore early stuff. And,
thing is, though, mate, I would imagine, tell me if I'm wrong, but I would imagine after what you went through, losing physical objects was probably nothing.
Oh, yeah. No. So the vice versa was. Okay, so that was a couple of years before. So I just did it so we could go on holiday.
Oh, I see.
James, but what James did for me was, I said, so about 2010, he bought me as a Christmas present. So from his own money when he started working and stuff, he bought me, let's have a look. So it's the Judge Dredd, you know, Judge Dredd, Case Files, number one, and the best of 2000 AD.
Wow.
Because he knew I loved this stuff, yeah?
Yeah.
And I'd literally stopped reading comics. I just had turned my back on the whole thing. And this is someone who lived and breathed them for 15 years from the age of seven, you know, up to 22, 23. Literally, I've done my own comics, I've done everything, and had stuff published. And anyway, turned my back on it. And bless him, he got me back into it. And I started just, you know, and then the internet turns up, right? You know, so we're talking about 2007, 2008. I start a Facebook group. It was called then, 1977 to the present.
Oh, yes.
A really clumsy name that turned into 1977 to 2000 AD, okay? So although that's like been going like 13 years, it used to be me and a couple of blokes and, you know, not a lot else going on.
Because over the last few years, it's become more and more popular, hasn't it? And
people have become aware of it. Part of the plan, you see. So James unfortunately passed in 2015. And from that point on, I went, do you know what? I want to start doing a little bit more of the things I want to be doing. Yeah, I think we all got to sort of make that decision.
Yeah, I would imagine that would make you really think about that, actually.
Yeah. Well, it does. But also, is it just that thing of, you know, all us getting a little bit older and some people go and buy a flashy red sports car and some people think I'm going to make a comic one day. And I've had a long-term plan. So what I knew I needed to do was find some like-minded people, Shane, because I wasn't going to conventions or festivals in those days. I mean, I used to go to the UCACs back in 87 and 88. I mean, that's the last ones I went to. Do you know what I mean?
We probably saw each other then.
100 people in a pub in London or something. Do you know what I mean? That's what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, seriously, it was no problem at all. You know, you go down Denmark Street and it would literally be, that famous one where the 2000 AD annual got signed, I went to that one. And literally, it's about six people, all beardy kind of blokes, you know, and now you look at this Bolland, Moore, Gibbons, you know, O'Neill and Aquera or whatever, and you just go, wow, in a little room in the back part of a shop. And these days, they fill, you know, San Diego Comic-Con.
Different times.
But anyway, so I was doing the internet thing and started to come across some really, really interesting people. You know, people like, I mean, in the background, people like Steve Green. Yeah. Now Steve Green is like total dude in the film world. Yeah. And when he gets involved, he did the logo for us for our comic, you know, and all I needed to do was make a donation to a charity for him. And then obviously I started with the logo. I thought I'll get a logo going first of all. Get the logo.
It's a good start. It's a good place to start. Yeah.
And then pulled in a few of the people. And then we did a competition. We got involved in that Droptober thing. That I don't know if it's John Burdis who actually started Droptober. So it doesn't matter. John's a good guy, and he's always the seller of dread, isn't he? Yeah.
He's a good man. He's a super fan, isn't he? Yeah.
Exactly. So I went to a couple of Lawless and met all these lovely, lovely people. Dreadheads and stuff. It just sort of built its own momentum and started chatting about it. And then I did a podcast, like, not with you this time, it was Clark, I think Eamon Clark. He was a totally lovely bloke. You know, he's frontline surgeon. He's proper.
Is
proper,
he?
Mate, right. There are people out there that do proper jobs as well as these lovely things.
I won't tell you what I do for a living.
Well, Shane, I do actually know. So. So yeah, I got chatting to him on a podcast, and loose tongue, I said, "Yeah, I'm going to do a comic this year," and that was in the Easter. So I thought I better get on and do it now. So I went away to France over the summer a couple of years back, and then I started pushing out these really absurd kind of like promotion things, saying Project X is coming, you know, watch out, this big thing's coming. So because we got these other groups as well. I've got these other Facebook groups. It wasn't difficult to get people going back to me saying, "I don't know what it is, but can I have a go?" And I'm like, "Yeah, who are you?"
Just create the interest. Yeah,
exactly. And then before you know it, you've got some names involved. And I'm not saying it's all based on bravado, but it's all based on, hang on, what is it now? It's not Bill and Ted. Wayne's World, you know, book the band and they will come. You know, it's that whole notion of set something up. And if you're enthusiastic and if you're genuine and people kind of see that and want to get involved. And we've had a lovely time. So I've got to say, Shane, I've literally... We're coming up to Kickstarter 4 at the end of November, but our issue 3, not sure if it's going out this week. What are we? Our date's the... What's the date? 19th,
we're on the 19th of October, and I think the issue 3 is scheduled for early November, isn't it?
That's right. It's a couple of weeks' time. So now that's really great. But I can just say, Shane, that literally half of my comics were booked up in the first 6 months. Wow. And there were these names just saying, I want to do it.
Yeah.
So we've got coming on board, who's not been there yet. We've obviously had PJ Holden, which was awesome.
I've seen some great names involved. A lot of people.
I've got Mike Collins is doing some stuff. Yeah. And then we've got other names. I'm just like, I had to go onto IMBD or IMDb.
Oh, right.
And I found out about these people because they're like proper film people who know kind of Duncan Jones and the Kingsley brothers. And I'm like, oh my God, these are proper people here. And what they're doing is they're sort of saying, I've always wanted to do it.
Yeah.
I do scripts for films. I just wanted to write a comic.
And it's an outlet, isn't it? I think that's the thing. You're giving people an outlet for maybe something that they've not had chance to do before. You know, it's a free... Seriously. It's like a... I mean, one of the other questions I wanted to ask, actually, was with 77. I keep calling it the 1977, which sounds like a bad Sky TV show, but there you go. So with the 77, I've wondered, do you give sort of editorial direction? Do you give any briefs out, or is it a total free for all?
It depends who it is, Shane.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, and it doesn't mean necessarily whether they're experienced or not. But what I do, right, so I'll give you a little bit of the run through. Mm. I generally don't accept a team. I don't say, oh, you're a writer and you've got an artist and you want to do something. I generally say, you're a writer, I'll find you an artist.
Oh, right, you do like that.
I like to read the scripts because I've got so many people who want to get involved.
Yeah.
So, for example, I hope she doesn't mind, right? But Robin Henley, she won the 2000 AD Talent Art Competition last year, which was announced at Thought Bubble. And I was supporting Sinclair Elliott, who... is one of our artists. He does Division 77, and he entered as well. So I knew Sinclair. We met in the bar. I said I was going to, we're online, and I said, I'll meet you at the Thought Bubble. Met in the bar, and it is like nerve-wracking, mate. This competition is just the most insane thing. I don't know how these people do it. And I've given myself 6 months when I was made redundant 3 years ago to think, can I go back into artwork? Can I do drawing? So I've got the table. I even bought myself a little Cintac, you know, and I'm doing all that. And I'm pants. My drawing is rubbish. I know I'm not going to be a drawer, so I've got to do something. And editing is easy, right? And anyway, this Robin character, she won, and her stuff is just awesome. Mm. And I tried to get in touch, but I tried to speak to her afterwards, but Michael Mulcher basically just kind of kept her talking for half an hour. And I could see she was edging to get out. Yeah. It wasn't because of Michael. It's just she had to catch a bus or something. Anyway, she's got in touch recently. And I'm like, ooh. Fantastic. We had a chat. So we try and talk rather than just being like in emails. I'm thinking,
it's good to have a chat, isn't it? You get a lot more done with a chat.
You do. And then there's nothing they can pin you down on then. You can say all sorts of things. I said, anyway, and I just had a phone call or two a week before from Ian Edgington. And I'm like, Ian Edgington, Robin, she wants to do horror. Well, doesn't Ian do a little bit of, you know, whatever, you know? And I like putting people together, so I've done that quite a bit actually. And sometimes there's, we've had a couple of refusals. We've had a couple of people say,
well, that always happens out, doesn't it? I mean, when you're doing anthologies, I did the Dead by Dawn anthology for a long time, and we tried to get, you know, we did a similar thing actually. We tried to get a good mix of, you know, indie, pro, all different, you know, and you're always going to get some people who just don't want to do what you're doing. But for the most part, I found that the enthusiasm, when you give someone an open forum to do different types of work,
They say, what do you want? And I tell, what I generally tell them is, I try and tell them, because I've got my spreadsheets, I generally try and tell them what the genres are included in the comic, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I just say to them, look, it's anthology. You know, it can be anything. I said, I've yet to have a really successful sports story, and I don't think anyone has ever had, apart from Barry Tomlinson and Roy the Rovers, who incidentally, Barry has written a couple of strips for us.
Right.
And did Ghastly United, which was that really fun strip that Neil Sims did, the colour. It's a horror story, football story. Right. And that was in issue two. So we like kind of mucking about with genres as well, taking one thing and then superimposing on something else. So as I say, we got people who literally, we were reading as kids. Yeah, they were the editors. So Steve McManus has done a couple of strips. Barry Tomlinson, his son Jim or James, has done some. Then we got some other people. So we got Mike Weston's son. So Mike Weston is just one of the gods of British comics from like the 50s and 60s. Yeah. Well, his son's called Pete.
Right.
Pete's artwork is insane. Absolutely insane. Wow. No one's heard of him. No one's heard of him. He's got a famous name, but it's like saying, I don't know, you're Keith Floyd's son or something. You know,
so he's new on the scene. He's not done any comics before?
No, I don't think so. Anyway, but he does art. He's a proper artist, yeah?
Right.
And we're like, well, show us your stuff. And he's just like, wow, that is so out there, so different. And we'll give it a go. Now, he's not actually going to be appearing in the 77. We are a publishing company, so we've got, I'm working with Steve McManus on some new projects of his.
Cool.
So one of them, I should say, is, I don't know if you've read his second novel. So he obviously did My Life in the Nerve Center, which is a great fictional account of 2018. Because if it was purely biographical, I think he'd probably get sued. But he's done a similar thing with his time before that, when I think the strip, the comic was Valiant, which is the one that John Wagner and Pat Mills were brought in to sort of rescue.
Mm.
It may not have been Pat Mills. It might just be John Wagner. I get the backstory a little bit confused. Yeah. But anyway, so John took over the editorship of it, and Steve McManus was his junior. So this is before he went to Action.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's this story, just insane story of what it used to be like in the comics world in the 60s and 70s, down on Fleet, you know, Fleet Street, and that old British establishment of kind of army majors running publishing companies.
It's a bit like that, wasn't
really
it?
Really odd.
Very different industry to what it is now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't know. We've got a few soldiers and policemen working for us. I can tell you.
Yes.
I can't give names. you've got all sorts. But anyway, the premise of Sheer Gang Conspiracy is that it's a story about a comic that never appears because the building gets set on fire or blown up. It's hilarious. You've got to read it, right?
I've not read it. Yeah.
But in the back of it, the comic that's not published is called Blaze. Now, unfortunately, we can't call the comic that Steve wants to publish as Blaze, because unfortunately Blaze already exists, I think, on the Marvel line or something
like that.
Right? So we're calling it
somewhere.
Blazer, right?
You know? Blazer. Oh,
Blazer. It can either be something you're wearing or what else blazes? I have no idea. and then that quote there is from my favourite film. So do you know which film that's from? It was Blazer.
Gosh,
Dodgeball.
I think I've watched that once.
Five ways. Oh, well, Shane, we were having a great conversation. It's one of my favourite films. I like a film that makes me laugh. Anyway, Steve's book made me laugh as well. Mm. And at the back of the book are these five strips. And they would have been the strips that would have gone into the comic. So Steve's already written these scripts. And I read it on the way to my honeymoon, should I say, on a plane. And I read it on a plane. He said it to me and I was reading it. And I was laughing out loud, you know. And my wife said, what are you reading? I said, these stories are so funny. And they genuinely are. And we're publishing. So two of them appeared in the first couple of issues of 77. But what we decided to do is, instead of, how can I put this, having some stories appearing in one comic and then straight away rebundling them and selling them to someone else, which I don't think is very fair, really.
Yeah.
We decided to put his own title out. So it's going to be a completely retro title. And I kind of want to promote this a bit today.
That's cool.
So
yeah,
the whole notion is that someone has found these boxes of these old comics in a gaff down near Heathrow, you know, and they never got published they got published, but they never got sold. So here they are in these crates. And when you buy them, they're going to look proper old school. We are getting them printed on bog roll. You know, it's going to be, and hopefully we can keep the price right down and they'll be just 32 pages and it's going to be old style. I would love to have the old serrated perforation on
it. I was going to say, you're going to have the perforations and the hole punches and all that sort of stuff.
I know, but I've inquired and I've spoken to a paper supplier and a printer. And apparently, when you get about 50,000 comics printed, then you can have this paper. Yeah. It's really cheap, etc. Because it goes on, it's newsprint, you see.
Yes.
And that's how comics used to be so cheap, isn't it?
Yeah.
Apparently, I didn't know that comics used to be what was run at the other time of the day when the newspaper's already gone to print.
Yeah. So all on the same sort of paper. Print. This is it.
Yeah. Anyway, so Blaze is going to come out in April, Easter, and we're going to do a Kickstarter. It's not going to have to be such a big Kickstarter as the 77. I mean,
Because the work's already been created, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's already done, and it's a much smaller thing. So, I mean, if there's people out there listening who haven't bought a copy of the 77, I'd need to sort of explain, basically, what it's oversized, isn't it? It's an oversized comic, and it's bloody massive. I mean, so that's 70 pages we started off with. Now, it might get a little bit thinner because it costs so much to post.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. The weight makes a difference, and you've got to think about that when you're doing a Kickstarter, haven't you? You've got to think about the weight.
Because it goes over the 250-gram allowance now on letters. And we're saying to people as well, people are probably going to really complain about the next Kickstarter. Well, we're doing six a year, right? So we're kind of really doing a load. People do not realise that postage, international postage, has gone up 40% since September.
International's crazy now. Yeah,
gone mad. So even our comic, even if we literally lose money. It sounds nuts, but we would lose money on £6 postage sending it to the States. Because it's actually more like £8 now. It's just getting bonkers. Yeah. So. Yeah. I don't know, Dave. Maybe David Lloyd's got it right with Aces Weekly.
Well, he hasn't got to worry about all that, has he?
Well, no, he's more concerned about trees. He thinks that we need to keep all the trees. And I'm up on that, absolutely. You know, I'm as green as they come. But to be honest with you, our buyers, and I'm sure most people appreciate this, a lot of collectors. And I don't think people collect PDFs, mate. I don't really think they do.
You can't collect a PDF. That's the thing about. I mean, I've got nothing against digital comics. I personally myself. Don't enjoy reading them, but that's just me. But I've got nothing against the idea of them. But if you're a collector as well as a reader, which I would say at least, I would say 80% of comics readers are also collectors.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's no real impetus to buy a digital comic or a digital annual or anything like that because you can't collect it.
No, it's a tough one. And you can understand. Mm. So we've opened a new shop on, what's it called now? Big Cartel. Don't know. It's online. It's one of these things. I know. You can stick five things on it for free.
Right.
And I think it's linked in either with Facebook. It's one of those, like, Amazon have got Comixology.
Yeah.
Facebook are doing their new thing.
I
mean, anyone who's got a shop on Facebook will know over the last couple of months, Facebook have literally turfed everybody off their shops. All your inventory's disappeared and you have to repopulate.
That's a pain.
Oh, it is. So we've had to do exactly the same thing. And then someone said to us, well, if you've only got five things to sell, go on this other one because it links in and it does clever things. And, you know, I try and keep up with all of these techie things.
There's so many things coming in now. Everything's changing so quickly, isn't it?
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, someone was saying to me the other day, oh, you don't need your own website. If you just have Facebook and if you just have Twitter and if they have them directing to a shop, I mean, I don't know. Because here we are. I mean, Shane, if you chatted to me a year ago and said, oh, you're going to be bringing out a comic next year, great idea. And what are you going to do to market it? I would have said, oh, yeah, we're going to sponsor a convention, which we'd lined up, and we're going to make a big show there, and we're going to have loads of freebies and T-shirts, and then we're going to go to another few conventions, and guess what? COVID came.
Yeah.
And that's why Pat didn't
go replan
his copy of Spacewalk. But we went ahead and we were literally exactly, we replanned, but what we didn't do is reschedule. Maybe we should have, I don't know. But it just meant that we really, the team and I, because we've got five of us involved in the company, none of us are strictly experts in this online stuff, but we had to learn really quickly. So
I think in general, in publishing, there's always a big learning curve, mate, to be honest.
I've got my publishing law book over there and that's, you know, Judge Dredd and his law book looks thick. This is
it's a minefield, man.
Exactly. So I'm still at the point where, to be honest with you, Shane, I could take any hints off everybody. We're still trying to. We're working on that whole notion of sexist words. I know, but gentleman's agreement, right?
Yeah.
We say, you know, you own the IP. Everybody coming to 77 owns the IP. We'd like to print it, and we would enter negotiations with you on reprinting. You know.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that, how your model worked, actually, because obviously...
Yeah, well, it's this notion that I picked up on, which is the French model, which means the original creators own the IP. So even if one of them disappears or takes a sabbatical, they still get royalties because they created it.
Yeah.
And it's very much the thing that I've been reading for a few years now on Pat Mills's blog and other people. And it just means that it pays for creators to create new characters. Because otherwise, if you don't own the IP and it's printed by a publisher, well, they're going to take it off you, and then they could necessarily could invest loads of money on making it a more prominently known comic. You know, who's to say? Yeah. I honestly, the thing that makes spurs me on is that the hope that one day, and it's nothing financial, it's just that what I mean is that maybe one or two or a few of our creators might be the people who go on and do the next Deadpool or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I might just have a little part in that. So what we're trying to encourage is saying, look, you keep the IP, work with us. We'll continue to obviously, we know the Kickstarter pays for the publication of the comic.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, us as the publishing house, you know, we're all volunteers. We're doing it because, yes, we have some work in the comic as well. I mean, I do Skate Worm and other people do Division 77. There's the V and, you know, the other sort of strips in there as well. But we're doing it because we wanted to do a comic. And, you know,
for the love, days, basically.
Well, yeah, maybe, you know. But the thing is that I'm really determined to continue doing this. I know, and I've got a bit more part time in my work, and really we're trying to be professional, so we've set up a company. And
so you're looking then to make it sustainable. So
that's the big thing. If we
So it's a bit of a leap, isn't it? From because you know, you obviously, I'm not saying that you know the current model isn't sustainable, but I think you're probably looking to maybe change the model a little bit so that it's got that sustainability.
You mean come off the Kickstarter?
Well, not necessarily. I think there probably is.
I mean, that's what I'm saying as well.
There's probably a sustainable model with Kickstarter, isn't there?
Potentially. There are, exactly. So, you know, for those people listening and maybe don't know about Kickstarter, it's worth just kind of going over that point. So it's crowdfunding. And basically, the Kickstarter is very much you have to achieve a target and you need people's support. And obviously, because we've got social media platforms, et cetera, we can generate some interest and hopefully we get back the people who've already gone in. And so far, I think we've had about 700 different people pledge over the three. Not everyone stays because what happens is, you see, now we've got, and we'll chat a little bit about this later, no doubt. We've got a distributor, Get My Comics, or Comic Toolbox, which is their name, depending on which side of the industry you're in. So I believe it's Comic Toolbox is the name of the company run by Adrian Clark, which does the catalog for shops.
Got you.
But for customer facing, it's called Get My Comics,
and it's the same company, and it's two different sides.
We've been pretty much when we set up, entered long negotiations with Adrian, talked about what our hopes and ambitions were, and I got to say they've delivered. You know, they've really helped us, and they sell. You know, they sell comics of ours. We're also being with Space Warpers, a sister publication now. Brawler, which I mean, I love Steve Tanner's work.
Great.
You know, it's anything
great
he does. And then you've got your Jeff Senior and you know, To the Death. And there's some quality titles that we're now kind of sister publication to. And I love that whole notion.
Yeah. It's like a little wave, isn't it? It's like a little new wave of these indie books that are really cool.
Definitely. And the way to get this sorted, we were talking about postage and delivery and, you know, WH Smith's has not been particularly selling things and Diamond UK disappeared and da-da-da, is that new publishing companies and new distribution networks are going to have to be established.
Yes.
And we're talking, I mean, Get My Comics is a different level to us. You know, we talk about, we're talking about thousands of pounds. I guess their business interest when they've got properties that they have to, you know, and employees is a whole different level. But it's good to know that they're still at heart comic fans. They really are. They love their comics and they're producing their own comic. And let's mention that briefly. So that's called Shift.
Yes.
And some of the guys who've worked for us and vice versa have done stuff with them. And that's going to be great. And that's a very similar price.
It looks really nice. I'm actually talking to Adrian in one of my other shows. I think it's going to be the end of this week. I think we're going to do a live cast. So
it's interesting, isn't it, that this price point seems to be bandied around by quite a few companies now.
Yeah.
In that, so Space Warp, I think you get a signed copy for $9.99. And I can understand Pat Mills wanting to, you know, boost that sale with an insert with sign. Absolutely fine, no problem at all. But I think the actual cover price without that is $6.99.
Ours
is $6.95. Shift is $6.95, and we're all around about 60 to 70 pages. So it seems like there's this new kind of model which is based upon the fact that the floppy has problems selling and people don't seem interested.
Well, it's not good value, is it? It's a value thing, I think.
Yeah.
I think you need to offer value, don't you? And what you guys are offering, from what I can tell, and what all these other titles are offering, at the higher price point, but better value. So, like,
so go way back to when I was saying about the comics that I used to be involved in, and then they started when Deadline started.
Yeah.
So like Deadline was £2.50 back in 1990. Well, 2000 AD was 65p.
Yeah. It was a higher price point. About,
so it was a higher price point. But if anyone looks and they've got the old Deadlines, quality paper, you know, it was McEwan, it was Ewins and McCarthy, and these other kind of crazy
creators.
Very creative people. I mean, Tank Girl comes from there, you know, fantastic stuff. Mm. And all I'm saying is that what we're trying to do is produce make a product that in itself stands up on its own and says, I'm more than just a comic. You know, we don't do magazine features. We probably may start doing that because editorial, look at it this way, editorial is cheaper to do than commissioning artwork. Yes,
so, it is.
Me writing a few hundred words and having some photos in is cheaper. But we haven't gone there yet. You know, we might do that for some sort of reprints or annual stuff.
I think editorial can be good. Like, Brits, I find, like editorial in their comics. Because we're looking at starting something, me and Andy, soon. And it's something that we've done before. And we never did any editorial. And we talked about it and we thought, we're going to do it because people like their comics in Britain to have a personality. Yeah. Whether that's the personality of the editor or the personality of a group of creators, they like to feel that there's a little community.
Well, look what happens when a major puts together a collection, right? Mm. In those collected, you know, deluxe volume bound things. I've got the Sandman things behind me up on the shelf there and very other things. They always have covers and then they have an interview with the creators and then they have a little bit of a, you know, of a chronology kind of thing. And that's the point, is that they're not offering features. What they're offering is background and more detail and information. And I think that's the point, is I think, you know, when we, for example, can stitch together, I don't know, 20 odd pages, because what we always thought was, and I've spoken to various European editors about this, there's a lot of interest in what we do, but not at the moment, because we're doing the 4 to 6 pages.
Yeah.
But our notion is, as soon as we can get comic strips stitched together that now go into 4, 8, 12, 16 or 20, whatever, suddenly then you've got stuff which people would have said already that they'll be interested in taking off our hands, right? Reformatting, and then we can have our own little floppy in terms of a comic, slightly bigger format, can be with a feature, with covers. Because people said to me as well, why don't you do that to begin with? And I'm like, well, do you know what? To ask someone who's literally having to be paid at the back end to produce a 20-page comic up front,
it's a lot
and they're
to
not
ask.
Making any money.
Yeah, it's a lot to ask, though, Liz. Yeah.
I think it's an insult to the industry to call myself a publisher, because I'm not paying people up front. I have to be honest about that. You know, we have a page rate, which is what it is, you know, but the point is that people have the IP. And the thing is,
they're going into it, aren't they? They're going into it knowing what that is. You're not being dodgy or anything like that. It's very, what's the opposite of opaque?
Transparent.
Transparent, that's the word I was trying to remember.
I'll be honest with you. If this was later and I'd had a couple more drinks, Shane, I probably might discuss what some people have alluded that publishers are, and name some publishers who I think have done a good job in the British industry over the last 30, 40 years, who actually have still managed to be able to continue to produce stuff. And let's be honest with you, you know, I'm not saying it's dog eat dog or this and that, but look what happens in the film world. Look how many film studios there are these days. Look at how many media companies there are. And we're the tiniest of the tiniest little thing at the moment. We're an amoeba, and there's things that would gobble us up as soon as possible. So that's why we created the company. So we got some rights. So we've got some protection. So
you've got to do that.
The creators who are on board with us, they at least know that everything is copyrighted and it's got a proper imprint at the beginning of the comic. And that should things become slightly difficult, no one's going to necessarily, we won't lose money. They can come and take my typewriter away and my photocopier, you know, but at the end of the day, I'm not going to lose my house over it.
No.
And you know, because as I said, I'm in for the long run. And we are still working at, I'm saying, low thousands, but I've seen and studied and worked with people like the guys, Donalds from Viz, and seen them and seen how they went on and how that grew and grew. Now, I'm not worried that, for example, what people might say, well, what's a successful comic? Because there's been a lot of chat about this recently, I think. And it's very genuine. People are saying, what is successful of being a comic? And I'm like, the next comic, the one you're on, the one you're working on, the fact that you're doing it. And, you know,
the fact that you're able to do it and, you know, not go bankrupt. because that's what it's like in comics at the moment. You know, that it's really difficult for all sorts of people in the comic industry, whether you're a successful creator, you know, a writer, publisher. It's really difficult to make it work.
Look at the news this week. I'm going to show my ignorance here, but the story I recall, do you recall the name of the new guy that Rebellion have got over, the editor, the American editor who's going to come over and start doing sales work from in the United States?
Oh, I don't remember his name.
Robbins, I can't remember his name, yeah? Anyway, everyone talking about him says, wow, amazing move. Rebellion are going to kind of turn up now and do some stuff in the States. They've owned the business for 20 years, and they've put money into it for 20 years.
Yeah,
I think they deserve some payback.
Yeah,
absolutely. But it goes to show that these lads who go out there and they've got all their IP for their games, you know, they're a gaming company, aren't they?
Yeah.
And they've kept this little comic afloat. And I just doff my hat, because they must literally, I'm not saying they lose money, and that's a controversial statement, but
yeah, but it's not a moneymaker, is it?
It's
no, definitely not.
Not those numbers. To the latest game of theirs that sells 5 million copies on the first day for 50 quid a hit.
I think that 2000 AD, the magazine, you know, in a little bit like in the way that Marvel are owned by Disney, and, you know, Warner's own, well, AT&T owned DC, it's an IP house, isn't it? It's a way of keeping IP. If it only has to break even, and it doesn't matter really, as long as they're not losing a load of money, they are retaining the IP of all these amazing characters.
I want to keep the creators who are producing and showing their belief in us, who are still, you know, are going to continue to write 10-part series. Yeah, I want to say to them, do you know what, guys? We will publish everything you do. And I think it gives them a chance to really hone and sharpen their writing and get the artists come up to speed and just improve and improve. And who knows, you know, maybe already someone's read it and they go, oh, you know, we'll phone those people in the United Kingdom. Who knows? But maybe not. Maybe it'll have to be in 2 years or 3 years time, and it'll take that long. But what I'm saying is, if you don't do it, you stand no chance.
No,
you've got to be in it to win. That's the notion, isn't it?
And that's right.
As far as I have a day job of being an editor, which is that lovely position of saying what goes in a comic. The hard work, and the one that I'm really, as you say, is a steep learning curve, is the publishing. Mm. And I don't come from a publishing law background, you know, and I'm kind of...
It's really, and it's a lot of stuff. It really is. But you do learn it, you know. I mean, I've been publishing since 1994. But I knew nothing for 10 years. You know what I mean? I just floundered away for about 10 years, making lots of mistakes and not asking the right people the right questions, being afraid to get help, you know? I mean, that would be the only advice I would ever give to anyone who got into publishing. Speak to people who know what they're doing.
Let's be honest about this stuff. You learn, I can learn, chatting to you, Shane, I learn stuff, all right? I'll be honest, right now, I had a lovely, I did an amazing podcast. No, it wasn't a podcast, it's a webinar. With a guy called Tom Ward. Now, I don't know if you know Tom Ward's work. Yeah, so he does Met Mr. Merrick, the Elephant Man.
I know Tom.
Yeah, so me and Tom did a webinar for Lycath, and that was a paid gig, and it was fantastic, absolutely brilliant. Mm. I'll tell you what, Tom's probably 15 years my junior. I think he is. He's 37, 38.
He's a young lad, yeah.
And I'll tell you what, only stupid people don't listen to other people. Mm. I learned so much from Tom about kickstarting, and I'm there as supposedly some expert. I mean, I've done three. That doesn't make me an expert. What I'm saying is, I think they wanted me on board because of my aspect of the social media stuff.
Yeah.
We've got all these groups and Facebook and Insta and Twitter and all this stuff that we do. And I genuinely say that Tom's knowledge and these people's experience. I mean, you know, if people want to know about how to do a Kickstarter, you go on Kickstarter, you look at the successful things, and you see who's been repeating it, and you get in touch with them. Get in touch with them.
That's and then you listen to what they say, because that's all you're going to do. You know, I always think that. You want to be successful like somebody, you just listen to their advice. You know, I think it's so easy, isn't it, to just not listen and to just dismiss advice that's given to you because you've got this idea in your head.
About it being a new kind of model. I mean, I don't necessarily think that Duncan Jones will do another the same way he did with Alex DeCampi's Maddie, which is that, you know, it was a huge, if people don't know, I think they raised a third of a million.
Yeah, it was a lot of money. It was
a lot of money. And it's going to be amazing. But there's a notion now, it seems that what's happening is that these, not them, but major publishers are using new titles and they create these new publishing names, and they're kind of going in the auspices of being amateurs They're not. They're creating Kickstarters, and it's all a little bit. And you're wondering, well, what it shows really is that it's a really popular medium at the moment in the way of fundraising. And I think that people need to say, well, that means have a go. And that, for me, brings it all the way back to the whole notion of 77. So you joked earlier about 1977. Yeah, well, when I was reading 2000 AD, and when things were happening in 1977, which was all very much do-it-yourself, some people call it punk. I, you know, it's that whole notion of people doing things themselves, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And my whole notion of the 77 means it's just, we're going to do it ourselves. That's all. We're not going to be a major player. And we're going to need support, but we, you know, I've got a guitar, I've got three chords, and I'm going to play it. And that, and I got, you know, and that's where we started from. I had a logo. Well, Malcolm McLaren had a designer first.
Well, yeah.
He had Vivian Westwood before he had the musicians.
Yeah.
And he went and saw MC5. He went and saw the American punks first, and went, I'm going to create a boy band. We'll call them Sex Pistols. And that's
created a brand.
Bands, you know?
Created a brand, didn't he?
Yeah.
And that's what you're doing. You know, that's why you start with a logo, is because first of all, you create the brand, then you create the audience, and then the product starts to actually start to be a thing. I think sometimes there's a lot of labor going into what you call a product, maybe, that for want of a better expression, and without any attention at all to what it is that you're actually trying to sell and why people would want it, you know, and that's where the branding comes in. And I think a lot of small publishers actually make that mistake. They create wonderful work, you know, really, really nice books with great artwork, engaging stories, but with zero branding. And that's the difference. That's what I mean. We're going a little bit off piece here, but
well, I mean, also because we've got our social media input, we can basically run. I wouldn't say it's competitions. That sounds a bit kind of, you know, vain, but we can post that we're interested in accepting submissions. Yeah, and as soon as we do that on Twitter, I can tell you, if I was to ask Dave Bedford, my guy on Twitter tonight, to put another call out for submissions, there'll be 20 things in my inbox tomorrow.
Yeah, it goes mad, doesn't it?
And the fact is, because it's Twitter, they're all over the place. Do you know what I mean? I've got stuff from Argentinians. I've got stuff from people in blooming Ghana. I've got things that I've, you know, the first, it's amazing. And I'm just saying, you know, the notion of putting people together and making something, I always wanted to do it. But it was always very regional when I grew up as a kid.
Yeah,
I was in the West Country, and I went, you know, I knew people like who turned into Massive Attack and Banksy, and people like that. I knew these people, right?
Yeah.
But it was all very local. Nowadays, it's just people do, you can literally.
Well, it's international now, isn't it?
Universe. You can get out there. And it's fantastic. So you're, you know, Shane, I mean, you've probably got people involved who drop in and you've never met them. You don't meet them. You don't necessarily know them.
Not always, no. No, you might just like their work and that's it. And then you get to know them. But it is a challenge, isn't it? I mean, have you found, that's one of the questions I was going to ask, is have you found it difficult to sort of curate the books, or has it just been a natural, organic thing?
Well, we have various private message groups that the artists can get involved in.
Right.
Sometimes it means we have to close the message group quite quickly because we have an artist involved who, can I put it this way, like, you know, has a reputation of being someone who lets everybody know, but everyone has a voice. No, it's important that people know that they have a voice and they can come through me as the editorial, but generally speaking, we got this notion, and it does sound a bit, I mean, I am not a Marxist, right, in that respect, but we are a collective. In that, the comic is the sum of the people that contribute. All I can do is put it together and say who's going to be able to be available and when we, how long their stories are running and stuff. But we've got some really, really, really vocal and creative people, and they also want to know that the work that they can do and they can help other artists with. For example, we've got brand new people coming in. We've got people who are offering them tips on how to do certain things and help out with bits, and we've got people who are checking on, you know, some of the editorial work on the scripts. It doesn't mean I don't do it. I do, but you know, when you've got 14 strips going on and it's every other month, it's quite a lot. I mean, God, I tell you what, I do though, but just recap here. So I've worked a bit with Steve McManus. Just think for a moment, you're doing 2000 AD, right? Every week. I have no idea how these people did it. And
Incredible.
Then he was saying to me, but that wasn't the half of it. He said, if you want to go on holiday, you have to have a few editions already put to
in the bag. Yeah.
And you've got to do the annual and the summer special.
It's a big commitment, isn't it? I mean, anything like that where you do it on a regular basis. I'm learning that actually now with this podcast. This will be like episode 14 or something like that. I'm doing it weekly.
Wow.
So what I'm doing, I'm trying to record two a week, so I've always got a lot in the bag. But you only need to be ill for a week or something.
Yeah.
And then you miss your two slot, and yeah, it's a hell of a commitment. And that's just doing this, you know, which is, you know, a podcast is easy really compared to putting a comic together.
Are we gonna hear soon that there's gonna be like an advert break? Are you aiming for that sort of stuff as well?
eventually.
Sponsored by.
It would be nice. I mean, you start small, don't you? I mean, even more so than with comics, you know, with podcasts and things like that. You really have to.
Well, I guess in some respects, the comic was the answer to the question, which was not how can we monetize this? It wasn't how we can make, because we're not making money, but
how can you make it
sustainable? What can we do with the talent and the people who are interested in this? And then literally, we just put it out there on a couple of occasions, and we had such a response, and it hasn't stopped. So, you know, even if I was to run out of money in the next week or so, I would still go to six issues. And I'm not. But the thing is, you have to bear in mind, we were literally planning for one issue to go to a convention, which was Lawless. I'll name it now. We were going to do Lawless, and we were looking to get involved heavily in that. And that's all our intention was. Mm. And then we put this kind of call out for a comic. And then we had about 50 submissions. And we went, wow, we can do more than just one comic.
Yeah, you feel obligated then. You say, I've got to do this stuff. It's great. But so going forward then, obviously, it sounds as though you've got plans to give it some longevity. You're in it for the long haul. You want to try and make it sustainable. I've already asked the question, I suppose, but how do you see that happening? How do you see the 77 being a sustainable thing, and do you feel the pressure? Do you feel pressure of that at all?
I think basically, I've alluded before that we will stitch strips together, and we'll be able to do mini Kickstarters, which are only looking for a few hundred quid, right?
Yeah.
To be able to put together a comic in itself, which then becomes its own entity, and then that comic itself we can use in a PDF form to go and be a calling card to send to all the distributors or whatever. You know, it's like doing demos for bands. Because I work with bands, I understand about, you know, you never hired a 24-track studio just to do a demo tape. You did a demo, or if you did, you never did it for the full album, did you? You did it for a demo. I'm not saying the 77 is a demo, but it's our calling card. And what we want to do is we want to say, look, here's a quality of the product that we aim to bring out, and here's a wide variety of stuff. And these guys are going to be producing continuing series. And when they are continued and we put them together, so for example, V, which is this kind of gladiatorial story, science fiction gladiatorial story, it's in black and white at the moment, and it's Aid Hughes, who is just an amazing artist.
All right, yeah.
Space Warp, yeah. And now I've got to have the conversation with Aid, but I've had the conversation with the writer. So hopefully, Aid, forgive me if I've had a conversation with you yet, mate, and you're listening.
Well, hopefully you will have by the time this goes out.
Exactly. We're aiming to get someone to colour it, okay, to make it more accessible to a different market. Because, of course, 70s or 80s comics in this country, half the pages were black and white.
Oh, always. Yeah.
So
a
British reader of a certain age is quite comfortable with that. Try and tell that to an American,
right? Yeah. Or anyone under the age of 40, really.
Yeah, exactly. They exist. Yeah, exactly. As a teacher, I know that. And so what we're saying is rebundling or repackaging, looking to create a whole strip, and then eventually, who knows? I mean, V itself, if it runs to 10 parts, that'll be 50 pages. Yeah. And then we've got the covers. So we've had covers by Nick Percival. We've had covers by Leonardo Manco. I mean, these people are just like gods, you know, as far as I'm concerned, who were keen enough to turn up. PJ Holden's done stuff for Division 77.
Oh, PJ's great.
We've got Stuart Kenneth Moore doing stuff. We've got, you know, just so many people are doing stuff for us. That when we bundle it together and we repackage it, it can either go A as the wood-friendly, tree-friendly PDF, or it can go as a comic. We've got comic shops all over the country and all over, let's be honest, we've got American comic company, comic shops, not companies, but American comic shops.
I've noticed you've got some distribution overseas. How did that come up? Was that just through sheer force of will, just contacting these people, or Did you have a distribution?
They were members of the group, and we knew if we towed a certain line that certain people would be listening in. So we do a bit of marketing on who's in our groups.
That's good.
So, you know, don't worry, Shane. You're on our list. We'll get to you eventually. But it's a question of just saying to people, look, do you want to get involved? Can you help out? And there's this guy, I've got to name check him, James Simon. He is the coolest dude out in California, right? He's got a comic shop called the Isotope Comic Lounge in San Francisco, right? His story last week, you ought to see this on Facebook. He found on eBay his skateboard that he got rid of 30 years ago. He found his skateboard on
my God. Anyway,
so I've got friendly with this guy. And he's just saying to us, oh, I can't get enough. He said, your comic, there are people out here who love it. And it's just because it's quirky and British and all that stuff.
I could imagine San Francisco, you know, it's that market, isn't it? Yeah. So I suppose you can find these markets all over the world. They could be localized.
And if we could find enough of them and sell them each 20 comics, we'll be fine. But that's how this started, mate. Yeah. It wasn't through some big deal. They literally had someone who was on the phone, and that's what I do. I'm on the phone talking to comic shops, sending them approval copies, emailing them back, writing back, phoning back, bothering enough that they say, leave me alone, but I'll have 5 copies. Yeah. And then they sell them. And then they sell them, and we're doing.
And then they want more.
Because we're very lucky, we're funded through the Kickstarter, right? And this is where I have to take a more, sedate tone here.
Yeah.
Spending other people's money is a hell of a responsibility.
Yes.
Spending your own, you can be foolish with, We've all wasted our own money.
Oh, yeah.
But don't waste other people's money. And we see that the Kickstarter people are like investors. And
that's what they are, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I think that they would be pleased to know that what we're trying to do is we're trying to market ourselves. And I'll say this to anyone who gets into comics, forget creating a comic. The hard thing is marketing it and selling it. And that is 90% of it. Because now I say focus, I'm staying focused on how we sell what we've got. You know, we can continue, I hope, with the Kickstarter. Perhaps we've tuned into a new zeitgeist, which is this new funding model that people seem confident with. You know, I've had people, not ignorant people, don't get me wrong, but I've done interviews with press and people.
Yeah.
And they say, what's Kickstarter? And you
explain. Really?
Right. And then they say, why did you do that? And I say to them, could you name me a comic that was funded by someone going to a bank ever? Seriously. You can imagine going to a bank manager saying, I want to start a comic.
Hey, I tried it, mate.
You did? Years ago. Yeah. How did that go down? You can tell us. So tell me
actually, about your experience. I went to a bank when I was 22 and I said, I want to start a publishing company, but I need a little bit of startup money. I still live with my parents, so I've got no mortgage or anything like that. Will you lend me some money? And I did a big business plan, and they did actually lend me. I think it was somewhere in the region of, I don't know, a stupid amount, a little amount. I think it was 1,500 quid or something like that.
Okay.
So I went away.
Well, that's fair enough. Yeah,
I published some comics. I made absolutely no money because I didn't know what I was doing. I lost all the money. It took me about 3 years to pay it back. It was an absolute disaster, you know. I would have killed for something like
this. You're the reason I couldn't get a loan, Shane.
You. I killed it for everyone, yeah. I was amazed they lent me the money. But
did you manage to persuade your parents to kind of be guarantors or something?
No. They didn't even know about it. They'd have killed me.
Oh, right.
They'd have said, what are you doing? Get a proper job, you know. But I was doing this.
Okay, so perhaps I'm kind of totally wrong, but my point is that, you know, these days, so I've looked at, because now we're a business, you know, we're a company. Mm. I've gone online now, I've gone to kind of, you know, start, I'm a new business and started in the time of COVID. What can I get from you? And you look online and there's local county kind of help and there's links kind of things and business hubs. Anyway, the only thing I've been able to find is if I put up $4,000, they'll give me $1,000. I'm like, what's
match
the point
funding. Of that? It's not even match funding, is it? Because it's not as much as what you're putting in. You know, it wouldn't be so bad if you put up $4,000 and they gave you $5,000, you know, or something like that.
Absolutely. But, yeah. And I mean, what I'm learning very quickly, of course, is so people would maybe look at our Kickstarters and say, wow, they've raised 10,000. Yeah, it's a lot of money. Yeah, and you go, it is a lot of money. Then Kickstarter take $1,000.
Yeah.
Then the printing costs $3,000. And then the postage costs $2,000.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, your marketing and all your other costs cost another $2,000.
Yeah.
And we literally, every penny on top of that, we pay back to our guys. So talk about the collective. talking about the deal they get. Okay, they own their IP. But we literally try and just share every single last penny with them. And I mean, you know, I kind of wonder how, I don't know, I just wonder how else we can change the system. You know, we're going to have to keep doing the Kickstarter until somehow, is it, would you say, you know, what you want to do is you want to get subscriptions?
Yeah, I mean, I think what it is,
you know, you get 1,000 subscriptions.
It's finding multiple streams of income, I think, is the key.
This is it. It's multiples. It's not one thing, is it?
Yeah, one thing is not the answer. You've got multiple streams of income. So you've got your Kickstarter. You might have a Patreon. You might have, like you say, subscriptions is really good. And this could include, that could be linked in with Patreon or something like that. And it's all about building your fan base, basically. Yeah.
So I mean, you know, we've got the shop that we get, the shop that people might buy posters off us or t-shirts.
Merchandise is another thing. I mean, I always think of the comics themselves as merchandise. One way of doing it, I mean, is to put the stories out for free as web comics, right? And then sell the comics as merchandise. It's a little bit like how they do it with the indie music industry, you know, which I'm sure you're familiar with. You put the music out basically for free on Spotify. No one buys music anymore, do they? But you make the money out of selling merchandise, and CDs and vinyl are classed as merchandise. You're not selling music. You're selling objects that people want to collect. And that's how you get into the collector market then.
Absolutely. And we found that basically, if that's the case, you have to be so careful about how you send your merchandise out.
Yes.
That's the good thing about Get My Comics. Now, Get My Comics are not afraid to say, agree with a customer who said, your comic's turned up, it's got a twisted corner. And we're not talking about it's damaged to hell, but it's no longer mint. They'll just send another one straight out. Yeah. Absolutely no problem at all. Yeah. Now, when I do it, I mean, I'm saying the people can't necessarily see what I'm going to show, but I use, so you can see, I use those envelopes which have got the tear strip on.
Oh yeah, they're pretty good. Yeah.
You know, and then I put photographs do not bend or whatever. And it's in a plastic bag and maybe you bought it. Now if you're sending that to Australia, there's still a chance.
There's still
a chance. However, you could be sending it to Liverpool, mate, and it can still be twisted in half and bent through a letterbox.
Yeah, it only takes one bad postie. Yeah, one bad postie and it's dead, you know.
So customer service is another thing.
When it's a big thing. It's a big thing, mate. People undervalue customer service and professionalism, you know, how you treat the people who you are selling your products to. At the end of the day, look at all the big, massive companies, how they came from very little companies into huge companies. They built it around customer service. Amazon wasn't built on its products, you know. Amazon is not the biggest thing in the world because of its products. It's the biggest thing in the world because of its service. I believe that.
Yeah. You know? Well, there's other, we could chat quick. I'll mention briefly. So when I learned and I heard this other one, so I think Dell computers are still a thing. Yeah. Dell is still a
thing. I think so.
Company,
Okay.
But what it started on was not the notion that it sold computers, is the fact that it held people's money for 30 days. It held the money for 30 days, used the money, and then eventually sent the computer. The Kickstarter, we get the money after 21 days. If people don't know this, you have to be validated and you have to be kosher and everything be cool. And then people can still claim their money back. They can drop out. Okay. A sign of how successful we are is how small or few people drop out. So we had two people in our Kickstarter, our third Kickstarter, £60. I think in our second one, we had 4 or 5 and we ended up, I think, £170 or something.
I think it's,
they changed their mind or they ran out of money.
I think it's wise to take that into account, that you're going to have maybe a 1 or 2% dropout when you're working
out. Never spend money that you haven't yet got in your account.
Yeah.
And Kickstarter can still take the money out of your account up to a year later. So, which is why we've gone proper business, because now we've got a business account. So it's not coming out of my, current account. Issue 4, which we're kickstarting in a couple of weeks, that's going to be like our official business starting point.
Right.
Just for accounting and all that sort of stuff. And it'll be really interesting to see whether our numbers stay up and, you know, because what's happening, as I sort of alluded earlier, Get My Comics are starting to sell the comic, right?
So
we've sold, I think, since Pat has put together a print of Spacewalk, I think in this last week, Adrian said that we'd sold 50-60 collections of numbers 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, that's
so
good.
When you start adding, yeah, so you say, how are you going to be future proofing it? Well, when you've got number 1, 2, and 3 and you still got stock, you print a lot. That's what you do. You, the print is not a lot. He can store them, which is a fantastic thing.
Oh, that helps.
Well, when you how many times have you had your house full of boxes?
Still have, mate. Still have.
I know. I saw a thing on Facebook. Did you see that one of Des Skin? Was kicking out all of his Warriors.
He's just chucking them away.
There were people going nuts. Yeah. But you understand him because you're thinking, I bet he would like his bathroom back. You know.
Oh, I've probably thrown away more books and comics than I've sold. You know, in all my years, definitely. I mean, because I bought in bulk, you know, and when I was when I was doing Small Zone, the distribution company, I did that. So I don't know how long I did it for.
So what was the best? What was the title that you really wish that you'd not thrown away?
I'm trying to think.
Is there one that you go?
No bad calls. Actually, all the stuff I've thrown away was absolute trash that was never going to sell. And I had because in the early days, I didn't have a quality thing. It was just like, everyone, come on, I'll sell your stuff. I wanted to support everyone who was small press. Yeah. So I didn't have a quality thing. I just, unless it was really bad, you know, but the bar was pretty low, let's put it that way. So I had thousands of titles on my books. And, you know, I had to bin lots and lots of comics, you know, probably a good ton or two of comics. A few years ago,
have you looked one of your fellow creators in the eye and said, and said, I didn't throw any of your stuff away, and you're lying? Is that what you're telling me, Shane?
Well, if people start contacting me now, I'm sure there are some people I may have to lie to when they contact me and say, have you thrown mine away? You know, I'll just say, no, they all sold. They all sold. But the thing is, they'll know because if they've had the money or not. But like a lot of the guys, you see, I bought it in advance. Because I used to do sale return, and then I got sick of doing that because it was too much hassle. So I just started buying everything in advance. So all of the stuff that I've thrown away is mostly stuff that I bought in advance.
I mean, exactly. We do some sale or return. And to be honest with you, you might as well just... You might as well say goodbye to it because you're not going to see anything back. But you might as well accept that what you are genuinely doing is giving it away.
Yeah.
Because if you get something back, that's... I don't mean a return, but if you get some money back, that's lovely. But at the end of the day, you're probably going to A, forget... And B, the other guy will probably forget or whatever. So, you know, it's...
I mean, we did for a while. It was quite good, you know, in the 90s, in the sort of late 90s, when small press was really starting to take off and some shops were accepting stuff. Mm-hmm. We, you know, I was selling a lot of books to lots and lots of shops and directly as well through my website. Oh. And it really took off for a while. But then... the two things happened really that killed what I was doing. And that was number one, the internet became to the point where everyone sold their own books online. So they didn't need me anymore to sell their books. And everyone started doing shows. It wasn't just one show a year. It was, you know, 100 shows a year. So suddenly everyone was selling their own books. I didn't have to go to all the shows selling everybody's books because everybody was doing their own thing, you know?
Like I said, I didn't do conventions, right? For years and years and years and years and years. And they changed so much. So when I went to Thought Bubble, the first year was in Harrogate. Yeah. Oh, my days. 400 people. And every single stall has got, like, so much product.
Yeah, yeah.
And it blew me away. And at least it kind of made me realize that there's a heck of a lot of people out there because I wasn't quite sure of the situation. You know? And I met Neil Roach and I met Steve Austin and I met Connor Boyle and I met all these people who some are working for us now, you know, doing stuff. Yeah. Right?
Incredible people. Yeah.
And you're thinking, these guys are doing this whenever there's a convention. They're selling their stuff and they're getting out there. But the thing about conventions is it's good if it's your local one. But and obviously, if you're a guest, and I'm sure because you host conventions, you know, if you're a guest VIP and expenses are met, which is fabulous. Mm. But otherwise, to be honest with you, as a trader, it's a bit of a you have to balance it carefully.
Well, there's a lot of competition now. I mean, I've seen it over the years since I started doing cons, like putting them on, you know, for like the last 14 years. So I've seen this development as well of how some creators, I remember when we did our first show in 2006, it was our second one in 2007. Mm-hmm. There were people having tables walking away with thousands of pounds. You know, happy as Larry, you know, I've made $3,000 today and they're selling like three small press comics. And that wow, that's amazing. And then those same people now will be doing, to get that money, they will have to do maybe, I don't know, seven, nine, 10 conventions
potentially
to get the same money.
Potentially, you know? It's a hard one, isn't it, to get that balance of what people will spend and where and what they'll spend on. So, just say, we'll probably have to wrap this up soon, mate.
We will. I was just about to say that. We've gone over our hour, but it's been a really enjoyable chat. I'm really enjoying it.
You're welcome. We'll leave it there, shall we? So thank you so much, Shane, mate, honestly. Can I just quickly say, so hi to Dave, Bedford.
I was going to say, do you have any shout-outs?
And and Steve Bull and Joe Healy and Paul McCollum, who are the guys at 1977 who turned into the 77 and continue to work with me. And Adrian, nice one, mate. And I'm going to call out to another fabulous bloke, Ian Sharman, who's our art editor, who's a total dude. And puts up with a lot of grief from me at wrong times of the day and far too close to deadlines. Thanks, Shane. I mean, honestly, plus
thank
one.
You.
And do you know what I'm doing right now? I've now got to have a board meeting with the guys.
I've got to chat
about our next Kickstarter and get all properly professional and
well,
stuff.
Well, good luck with the new Kickstarter. And
thank you.
We'll maybe get you onto one of the live shows when that starts, and we'll promote that for you.
Oh, do you know what? That would be fabulous, because what we try and do is we do have a little bit of interaction. We try and get interaction between some of our backers. Mm. So we might offer, if it's possible, you come on ours. But basically, we could have people in the lobby who can just listen in and watch or what have
you. Yeah, that'd be cool.
We'd probably do that as a reward or something. We're always on the lookout for creative and original rewards. So
that
might be something. I do appreciate it. Shane, thanks ever so much, mate.
Thanks.
Cheers, mate. I'll speak to you later.
Great chat. All the best. Bye bye.
Cheers, bud.